Tape number four, the morning of January 7, 1961. You were talking of Chester Arthur, Mr. President.
Well, he sold the furniture in the White House for $6,500, nine van loads of it, and some of the pieces in it at the present day are worth more than the whole price he obtained for the nine van loads, but they can't be obtained now.
People did not choose to part with them, said it?
No.
Or were they lost?
I finally succeeded in getting a couple of chairs donated for the Lincoln Room in the White House that were sold at this time, and never was able to get any other furniture in connection with it. And the rehabilitation of the White House was carried on by myself and Mrs. Truman. And all the furniture in the various rooms was restored as we thought it ought to be, except in the foyer on the second floor, which is looks at when we left like a furniture store, and we didn't have anything to do with that. The Altman people set that up. But the rest of it we were responsible for.
Now, the what would make a president, an outgoing president, do a thing like that, excepting out of desperation? Was he broke?
No. He didn't like the furniture that was in the White House, and you'll notice in the last
Geographic.
He was selling the things that are in the White House, and they mentioned particularly mousetraps. That wasn't what he sold. He sold the great pieces of furniture that Jefferson, Monroe, and John Quincy Adams had brought to the White House. And those are the things that I was trying to retrieve.
No, but didn't he? This was an act that was highly reprehensible. This was a man who was selling something that didn't belong to him.
No. He had a right to sell it. He's president. Those things all belonged to the president when he was there, and he furnished the house with Victorian furniture, which...
Did he buy it with his own funds or his government?
No. The government gave him an appropriation to take care of these things, just as they did when I refurnished them.
That raises an important question.
Well,
as to ownership.
That's a question of taste, wasn't it?
Well, no. The president owns the White House when he's there. And he can do as he pleases with it.
Just a moment. He owns the real estate as well
he
as
the White House when
furnishes.
He's there. That's right. And he can do as he pleases with
well,
it.
That's
and
important.
Most
the first
of them
time
been,
I've heard that stated.
Most of them have been very careful about their tenure of the White House because most of them think that they're there as representatives of the people of the United States. And any president can do as he pleases with what's in the White House.
Well, what's your feeling about that, Mr. President?
I think it's all right. I see nothing wrong with it.
Well, during the
time... Nothing's ever been wrong. And I've done wrong with it, except the sale of this furniture I'm telling you about, that this successor of the man who was elected president did. And I'm sorry that happened.
But you mean that when the president is elected and he moves into the White House, he then becomes virtual owner of everything?
It's his, that's right. No question about it.
The White House, the grounds, the person, everything is his.
Everything is his. And most of them have been very careful to turn over in the condition in which they found it.
And yet you had so much trouble changing a balcony.
Oh, well, that didn't make any difference there. It makes no difference what you try to do for the improvement of the architectural situation of the buildings in the Washington. There's always a bunch of old women there who want to do something else. Same thing happened with the rehabilitation of the front of the Capitol building, which Tom Connelly and I worked out while he was chairman of the Public Buildings and Grounds Committee. And we worked out a plan, which was finally carried out. And at the time we worked it out, it could have been done for $4,200,000. It was finally cost $14 million to do exactly what we wanted, and they finally carried it out.
The rehabilitation of the White House?
Was
of the Capitol?
Capitol building,
was done by you?
Yes.
present, the trouble that you were in about the balcony of the White House was only really trouble in the press or comments of some
That's
of the architects.
All. Because that balcony was included. You see, Jefferson put that portico on the back of the White House, and Jackson put the one on the front. And the balcony was supposed to be included in it, as all Southern buildings on that basis have. And nobody quarreled about it. They didn't take it out after I left.
No, yeah. And nobody was stopping you from putting it in except criticism.
No, that's all. No, they couldn't.
That's right.
So when the 2 weeks
were put
out,
control.
The president has complete control.
Absolutely. Jackson put that front on the White House. And the two, the rows of pillars across the driveway should not be there. If those pillars were taken out and the two of them were put on the steps, even with the two that are there now, it would be in exact proportion as it ought to be. And I tried to get them torn down, but then they commission, which I had appointed, decided that there shouldn't be, and we didn't get it done.
But this was more a matter of tradition and taste and architectural viewpoint.
No architectural viewpoint, because the architectural viewpoint is wrong.
But had you wanted those columns removed, you could have ordered them removed.
Well,
that would have been it.
I could have taken them down. That had been all there was to it. But then I wanted the commission take them down, who was rehabilitating the White House, and they didn't feel like they ought to do it.
And you're referring now to the columns in the front?
On the Pennsylvania side of the building. That thing that sticks out there is not in proportion to the rest of the White House.
Just a fleeting thought here. Do you feel that outgoing presidents, having occupied and having been in this august place, are entitled to have a permanent home provided for them by the people
should
in Washington?
Be. Should be.
There should be a place in Washington?
Should be. Not necessarily in Washington, but wherever they want it.
And
I've got mine right here at home, so makes no difference.
Why do you think that's indicated for
every single head of state of every other great country has that prerogative. But we don't believe in it. In fact, they've, up until a short time ago, they just turned the presidents out to grass, let them starve to death, and six of them did.
Do you know why that is so?
No, I don't. It's principally, I think, because in a republic where people are in control of the government, they are of the opinion that the heads of state will be well enough off to take care of themselves. And they can't be.
Well, they were in the early days of the Republic.
Well, yes, they were millionaires before they went in there, but James Monroe died a pauper, and he was a millionaire. Thomas Jefferson died a pauper, and he was a millionaire. And I can name you several others who did the same thing because they would not exploit the fact that they had been presidents of the United States.
Well, doesn't that show that the people for a long time didn't appreciate or understand the importance of the presidency and didn't treat it with the importance it deserved?
Well, not that well. I think that's correct. But then you'll find that most of the presidents either had to go to work for industry or assume a position of special privilege, or they were allowed to just die in poverty.
Well, would you say then, in terms of its function, that the presidency has been growing progressively stronger and more important in its
No, it's always been that. But people are beginning to understand what it means. That's the point.
People are beginning to catch up, in your judgment, with the importance of the presidency.
That's great. That's great.
When did that start?
Oh, I think it started back. I'd say it started back with Theodore Roosevelt. That's where it started.
Mr. despite the fact that you had a Lincoln and that you had a Jefferson, you had a Washington, the full grasp of the presidency was not revealed to the people as yet.
Not until 20 or 30 years ago.
Now, how do you visualize the presidency in terms of its progression? Do you feel it continuing as a continuing growing force in the running of the country?
It's always been the top growing force in the country. Some periods didn't appreciate it. Some periods it did, and it hasn't had to grow because it's always been just that.
Well, then, from Lincoln to Cleveland, we've had four presidents, none of whom has made the slightest impact upon either the office or the country.
And that was true from Jackson until Lincoln. Same thing on both sides of it. And it's been true since Woodrow Wilson. And the same situation between Woodrow Wilson and Franklin Roosevelt.
Then we have it again.
Well, I hope we haven't, but we have.
Well, Mr. President, may I ask a question about Chester Arthur? Chester Arthur did invoke the first civil service in the country.
That's right.
And that was an important contribution he made.
It did. He made some important contributions. And the only thing I have against him is the state of the furniture on the White House. And that's personal and shouldn't have anything to do with his record as president.
Well, Mr. President, isn't it ironic that Chester Arthur was considered a politician who liked to dip his hand into funds or help his friends, yet when he became president and his cronies came on to Washington with a train, he sent his aide down to the train and said, "You fellas better go home, I won't receive you."
That's right. And that shows what effect becoming President of the United States has on a man. If he had received those politicians, not my definition of politician, but the word politician, as I say, he might have been renominated for president. But he wouldn't do it, because when he got into the White House, he learned what a tremendous job he had and how he had to represent the people. I give him credit for that.
Well, in a certain sense, then, he did add something to the atmosphere.
There's no question about that. No question about that. He did.
Well, one of the things there, just go back to Garfield, that I just glanced over, is the fact that he campaigned, his first president who campaigned in a language other than English. He campaigned in German as well as in English.
Yes. Well, in those German settlements, he could do that.
And apparently he mastered the language, and he had several other languages, so he was a man of considerable culture.
Oh, yes, he's a grand man, and it's too bad he got killed.
But didn't do anything of any consequence.
He didn't have a time. Well, he was killed in July.
This is the end of tape for the morning of January 7th, 61. This is tape number 5, the morning of January 7th, 1961.
All right. Now, why don't we
go on to Cleveland, where we
get right to Cleveland and...
What's your characterization of him, Mr. President?
Grover Cleveland was a great man. He was sheriff of Erie County, mayor of Buffalo, governor of New York State, and was finally elected President of the United States. And in his first administration, he was responsible for restoring the powers of the president after the High Court had declared that the bill passed, taking the powers of the president away from him, was unconstitutional.
This was the action taken during the Lincoln period.
Andrew Johnson period.
Where they declared that they couldn't fire any member of his cabinet.
That's right.
But go on, Mr. President. I'll pick that up.
Yeah. What, Ellen? We were
yes, you were going to talk to Mr. President about your your summary or characterization of Grover Cleveland.
Well, Grover Cleveland was one of the great men of his time. He was mayor of Buffalo. He was sheriff of Erie County, and he became governor of New York and was nominated and elected president of the United States. And he made a great president because he sat up nights going over the various parts of the correspondence that he had, and he himself decided on them. I think he, in his first term, was one of the six or seven great presidents of the United States.
Why, sir?
Why made him great?
Because he acted as president of the United States, and he had his troubles with Congress, and he was chief executive, as chief executive ought to have been.
What specifically did he do that stamped him with greatness?
He was the man who made the decision that the president of the United States was the chief executive, and in his term, he told the British that the Monroe Doctrine still worked when they tried to take over some territory in Venezuela to which they were not entitled.
When you say he said he was the chief executive, you mean that he had a right to select and fire his cabinet members?
That's right, and the Supreme Court finally supported him in that position.
And also, did he was a strong executive in the sense that you talk about they took charge of all the correspondence, mainly dealing with?
Well, he just acted as chief executive ought to act, and as the commander-in-chief ought to act.
Well, did he deal with any of the acute problems that were beginning to oppress the country in those days? One of them was monopoly, and the other was the
Monroe Doctrine.
Well, he did. He reaffirmed
he
the Monroe Doctrine.
The Monroe Doctrine in Venezuela.
And enforced it against one of the original backers of the Monroe Doctrine.
That's right. England.
Yeah. Now, he ran against Blaine, didn't he? Blaine was his opponent for the presidency?
No. Yes, I think he was in the first 1884. Blaine was his opponent, but he ran against Benjamin Harrison in the second.
But wasn't there raised during this campaign one of those periodic things involving bigotry, Romanism, and rebellion?
That's right, and that's what elected Cleveland. The old preacher in New York, I think. Made that statement, Romanism and rebellion, that elected Cleveland.
Now, that allied Blaine with the anti-Catholic group, or at least seemed to, and then he tried to get out from under it and didn't work.
No, it didn't. Now, and then Benjamin Harrison was the next president who ran against Cleveland, and Blaine was made his Secretary of State.
Would you care to comment a little bit on that kind of campaigning in presidential elections?
I don't like it. I think it's wrong.
Yet, this is the kind of campaigning that seems to whip up the voters into some kind of response. Talking reason to people doesn't seem to do it as well, does it?
Too bad, but should be. They should listen to reason, but they don't.
Well, Mr. President, what was this issue of Romanism and rebellion?
Well, it was first time a Democrat had a chance to be elected since 1776, and they were very anxious.
Excuse me, sir, you mean 1876?
Yes, I mean 1876. It was a bad situation for the simple reason that Cleveland was the first Democrat who had a chance to be elected in 1884, And they brought everything possible against him. And this Romanism and rebellion backfired on the people that brought it up.
In other words, they wanted to identify the Democrats with Romanism and rebellion. Where
That's
did
right.
the Romanism come in, Mr. President?
Catholic, anti-Catholic.
Yes, but where was the Catholic in this whole
thing? That was the objective, was to make it appear that Cleveland was for the Catholics. And they wanted...
Well, a lot of Democrats, Democratic leaders were Catholics, and they were backing, and they were identified with the Catholic bloc.
Well, yes, and that's been the case ever since, even in the last election that went on.
Do you feel that the Democrats have been less guilty of bringing in presidential campaign some of this scurrilous stuff that the Republicans have been doing so often?
Well, of course, I've always thought so. They brought into every campaign. The opposition has always brought it into every campaign, even the one in 48 when I was having trouble.
Why do the Republicans wage their contest on so low a scale, low a level?
Well, because they're inheritors of the know-nothings, the Whigs and the Federalists, who've always been against the welfare of the common people.
But they've always assumed a kind of an aristocratic employer superior attitude.
That's right, following Alexander Hamilton.
And they never accepted the Democratic administration in good grace, have they?
No, they never have. Andrew Jackson proved that in 1828.
So, in that sense, they were no better than some of the diehard Democrats of the South, who also...
Well, I don't like to mix them up with the South.
I see. Mm-hmm. Well, now, Cleveland's first administration, involved a strict and highly disciplined series of rulings by the White House or directives. It involved attitude towards labor, insurance companies that were growing pretty big in those days. And didn't all that get turned about in his second term?
Yes, that's true. He had been attorney for insurance companies during the period between his end of his first term and the beginning of his second, and his viewpoint changed.
What did he do about monopoly during his first term?
Well, I don't know that there was anything to do, but the Interstate Commerce Commission was set up a short time after he went out of office, which was to prevent railroad monopoly of transportation. And I think Cleveland had a great deal to do with that.
But it was during that period that you were going from a sort of pooling of interest in order to compete with the European industry. They were trying to take advantage of two things, mechanization on the one side and low pay to labor. So in order to overcome cutthroat competition, they got into what they called pools or gentlemen's agreements, and then they went out into suppression of competition, and you had Standard Oil Company under Rockefeller, you had the United States Rubber Company, you had the United States Steel, you had the International Harvester. All these giants were formed with the idea of not only suppressing competition, but exacting higher prices from the buyer, while the administration apparently sat by and winked at it.
Well, that's true. But those things were not corrected until Woodrow Wilson and Franklin Roosevelt became president.
Well, then, how could you assess greatness upon Grover Cleveland with this?
Only in his first term, he was a great president. His second term, he didn't do so well.
In other words, in his first term, he was expressing the lot of the common man, and
that's
he was
right.
representing it.
That's right.
In his second term, he seemed to turn about and got over with privilege.
That's right. And he didn't like Bill Bryan.
What was his quarrel with William Jennings Bryan?
Bryan was for the common people. And Bryan's idea of funding was accomplished in the Wilson administration by the organization of the Federal Reserve Bank, which then made enough of the circulating medium available to the ordinary fellow. And that's what Bryan wanted in his 16-to-1 silver thing.
But you would still assess Cleveland as one of the few great presidents?
Yes, I would. He's one of the five or six great presidents.
Were any reforms put through during his administration, excepting the one that you spoke of?
Yes, I think that reform we spoke of in the stopping of monopoly in his administration was
sure he did in the stopping of monopoly in his administration.
And as president, he really acted as president of the United States. Very few of them have.
He acted with strength and decision.
That's right.
We have come.
Yes, this is the end of tape 5, morning of January 7th.